طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح. طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, where each week you will hear the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian perspective, the Palestinian voice exploring the realities of the Israeli occupation of the Palestinian homeland. You will not hear this narrative very often in the Western mainstream media, which is why it is important that it is presented each week on This Week in Palestine. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham and is continued in his memory. This is your host, John Roberts. On March 28th, the Cambridge Bethlehem People to People Project held the first of what they hope will be a series of informal coffeehouse presentations offering films, talks, and discussions concerning the Palestine struggle against the Israeli colonialism and apartheid. This first offering took place in conjunction with three Harvard student organizations and was held in Harvard Yard. It featured Palestinian refugee, journalist, and filmmaker Ziad Samarouche, who also serves on the staff of the Middle East Children's Alliance, MECCA, and staff attorney of the ACLU and member of the National Lawyers Guild, Carl Williams, who joined each other in drawing the parallels between incarceration patterns in Palestine and the United States. This Week in Palestine was there to record the presentations for broadcast this morning. As is often the case, some of the presentation included a PowerPoint presentation, but the narrative informs us of what is going on, and therefore the broadcast is relevant for radio broadcast, even if we cannot see the images, and though it requires some creative editing. We begin with attorney Carl Williams speaking about the U.S.'s so-called criminal justice system, and will flow immediately to Ziad Samarouche's description and analysis of the Israeli tide of incarcerations of children and young people on the streets of Palestine today.
There's a bunch of stuff I want to talk about. I think that's connected to Palestine. And I think we probably met before.
Maybe
10 years ago, or at least in the same building at the same time in Palestine a bunch of years ago. Actually, right after that, I came back to the United States and decided to become a lawyer.
Yeah, I'm really proud of this mistake.
Maybe it was something you said. We just realized that just now. There are no coincidences. Things happen for a reason because, you know, people who are doing amazing work, like the people I get to sit up here with, do things that influence other people. And I think we should kind of all, we probably all do know that, but we should remember that. And I want to talk a little bit about the criminal legal system in the United States, some work in the Guild, some ACLU work, and how that, I want to sort of lay that out. I'm not going to, I'll maybe talk a little a bit about Palestine, but I'll certainly leave that to you. But I think the similarities will be obvious because I'll sort of point it out that way. And I think one of the things I think that is important to look at in the United States when we look at the criminal legal system, and I say criminal legal system because for many of us, there isn't justice in it, and saying justice in it is propagandistic, right? It's like, oh, this is the justice system. This is where you go to this building and get justice. And it isn't really. It's a building that you go to and you get locked up, right? And for most people who are interacting with it that way, that is not a system of justice. And so I think the terminology that we use is really important. So I say the criminal system or the criminal legal system. Because that's what it's like. You go in there, and you come out, and now you're, you know, by the system, you're a criminal. And that, in many ways, is what it's for. A lot of times people talk about that system being broken, and I think it's problematic, too, to talk about the system being broken, right? Because then it means someone built it in a certain way, and it was supposed to work in a certain way, and then it just, you know, like, the gear fell off, and it wasn't screwed on right, and now it's just accidentally incarcerating, and GPS tracking devicing and probationing and parole and putting on parole multi-millions of people by accident. It just got broken And that's propagandistic too. And also it makes it impossible for us to find a solution. If we believe it's broken, then it's like, oh, well, you know, in my analogy, you can just put the gear back and just screw it on tighter and then we'll be okay. Right. And that's what you see in a lot of, you know, what people call criminal justice reform. You say, well, if we just fix the bail system, we just fixed it a little bit and did it in a better way, then everything would be okay. It's like, well, yeah, but then the people who got 15-year mandatory minimums for possessing drugs or allegedly trafficking drugs, or the people who got their doors kicked in, and people who got, you know, charged where, you know, people on this campus, I will let you know, probably have some drugs, probably have sold drugs, and are not getting arrested for it. Right. So I'll say the National Lawyers Guild is an abolitionist organization. That means that believe that we can live in a society without prisons. And that is a thing that a lot of people go, wait a minute, how could we do that? And I'm going to give you a little mind experiment, because it actually fully exists. We live in a society that doesn't have prisons for wealthy white people. Right. So for wealthy white people, right, I finished a book about the SLA and Patty Hearst, and she spent, like, after robbing a number of banks and killing a number of people and doing some other things, she spent 22 months in prison and then was fully sentenced, commuted, and then fully pardoned. Right, that's what happens if you're rich and you do, you know, what is some of the highest level crimes in our society. And if you're brown, or you're black, or you're Muslim, or some combination of those things, or an immigrant, and you do those same things, you are not in the abolitionist system. You're in the other system, right? You're in the criminal legal system, and you're punished brutally for those same things. So I think that's an important thing to remember. But getting back to saying it's broken, it really is. I mean, you could say it's fixed. It's rigged. It's set up to work a particular way, and it does work that way. And if we don't look at the system as that way, and, you know, seeing the same the analogies to what happens, what Israel does, and what the world, what the United States does to Palestine and to Palestinians, it's a very similar analogy. That it's a system that is particularly planned. Right? No one looks at, well, some people do, but no one looks at Zionism and go, oh, it was an accident. This is happening. Right? And we have that in the United States. And it's sort of unfortunate, but we don't have a common parlance to talk about the system in the United States. I would suggest it's a system of white supremacy, right? Because the United States created what is arguably, that means I want to argue about it, if you don't agree. It's arguably the most lethal thing that has ever been created. I said that at a thing, and there was some folks from Peace Action, and they go, yes, nuclear weapons. They didn't say. And I was like, no, whiteness. Right? Because in the name of whiteness, right, arguably, more people have been killed, more people have been murdered, more countries have been invaded, more genocides have been committed, because someone said, we are white, you are not, therefore we can kill you and everyone who looks like you, we can take your land, we can push you off it, we can put you in concentration camps, we can put you on reservations, and we can kill your entire... For Native folks in the United States, a lot of times people say there was a genocide in the United States. Native people, like Seminole and Pawnee and Choctaw, did not consider themselves the same thing, right? In Europe, you consider France and Spain and Germany, those are different sets of people, right? Here, I think we think, like, there were Native Americans. No, there were hundreds and hundreds of ethnic groups in this country, hundreds of linguistic groups, and many of them fully do not exist now. Right. And that was a system that was created, right? Initially, it was like, we're Christians and you're heathens. And then they converted some people and they're like, damn, we need another way to define this. We need another way to make you an other thing. And that is the creation of whiteness here, right? American name, right? And I think thinking of that, that led to, you know, the multiple genocides of Native peoples. It led to, the system of chattel slavery in this country. And by extension, there's always been a system of social control in this country that is based in that white supremacy to this day. I mean, if anyone thinks that the fact that people who are the great, 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 great grandchildren of the people who were enslaved are the ones who are incarcerated now, or who are walking on the streets of Roxbury and Dorchester around Boston with GPS bracelets on their ankles, and controlled by that system, where, you know, 250 years ago, someone was walking around the streets of Boston, maybe, with a pass that said, I'm allowed to walk around because someone in some position of power said I could. Like, all that's different in that is the technology, right? All that's really different in that is the technology. And I think the parallels to you know, Palestinians and, you know, walking around with your little green plastic wallet and you having your identity card, it's like the similarities are unbelievably, I mean, it's unbelievable how much it is similar, right? Because people actually looked at the system and said, oh, that's interesting. That would work for us over here, right? Actually, in both directions. A lot of times people say, like, oh, you know, the Israelis are teaching the Boston police how to do this. And I was like, well, sometimes, like, we taught them and then, well, not we, but they taught them and then they taught them the same things back in terms of concentration camps, in terms of reservations, in terms of corralling people, building walls. It's a two-way street of oppression. But I think looking at the criminal legal system specifically, and how it parses out. So I just want to talk about that a little bit. And people can check out a little bit earlier today. The NLG had a really great victory that has come out in the media about some folks who were protesting pipelines. I'm not going to talk about all that, but some great stuff happened. Check it out online. Check it out on Twitter, Facebook, and stuff. But in every step of the process, so, you know, people have use the term school to prison pipeline, and some people say, you know, cradle to prison pipeline, that in every step of the process for people of color, for poor folks, for immigrants in this country, you are criminalized where you live, where you work, where you go to school, the hospital you were born in, the hospital your mother went to, you know, neonatally, or if she had access to that or didn't have access to that. All of those things lead to systems of criminalization for people here. And I think the similarities to Palestine are dramatic there too. That, you know, when you're born, like when you're born, where you're born, you know, this happens in hospitals. People say, oh, well, I think the mother was doing drugs. I think she was doing drugs. We're going to check if she was doing drugs and we're going to see. And then, you know, she might be criminalized for that behavior. It's like, they're not doing that thing at Mass General. Right. You don't go to Mass General and they're like, we're going to give you all these tests to make sure because your eyes look a little glassy. It might be because you have changed gender. But that thing happens incredibly early on, right? And it goes all the way through. Situations of, you know, having less public schools, charter schools, where people are incredibly disciplined, where people are pushed out, so the charter school performs better, and they can say, "Look, we had all our students graduate. We had all our students go to college because you pushed 25% of them out into public schools. And in the public schools, where there are armed police in schools, and that entire process is one of criminalization. And you know, people have seen the stats about." If you're disciplined, suspended, expelled at certain ages, the likelihood of incarceration prisons in some counties in the United States actually track building, they track what prisons they should build by how many kids at third grade level are getting suspended and expelled. So they say, oh, well, we're going to need another building because these folks, you know, are going to age up and we're going to need somewhere to put them. And we know people know those statistics, right? Which is a terrifying, it's also, it's surrendering to it. It's like, well, we have to, you know, it's going to happen, right? And it creates an inevitability. And when you build the prison or the jail, you need to fill the prison or the jail. But I think there are structures that, you know, that we've seen in Palestine, and I think there are structures here. One is, and I'll suggest it to you, this is a bit of an ACLU plug, but and also in a Guild plug, people are doing court watch projects where people are going into courts, documenting stuff that is going on, seeing like what happens, right? How is someone's bail set? What does bail mean? When someone is arraigned, you know, what charges are they being charged with? Are those charges mandatory minimum charges? That is a judge forced to give a certain sentence to a person, whether they think the person deserves that sentence or doesn't deserve that sentence? And the ACLU, the National Lawyers Guild, the Mass Bail Fund, and the Massachusetts Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, and Families for Justice Zealand, I know there were five, are all doing trainings around the state to bring people into courts to sort of tell them who all the players are and to do quantitative and qualitative analysis on what's happening in those courts. To say, who's getting bail set? What are they getting bail set for? Are the people able to pay that bail? What are the decisions the prosecutor is making? What are the decisions the defense attorney is making? and then also just more like narrative form to say, you know, what is happening? You know, did the judges tell someone they couldn't talk? Did an attorney actually seem to argue for someone? And a lot of that is, even though, you know, the United States is, you know, purportedly a democracy and we're supposed to be able to have access to these things, very seldom do people ever go to courts to see what's happening unless you're there for yourself, right? And I'll say this, every single time I've done it with Guild folks and we brought people in to support other people, every single time I do it, we walk out and people go, I can't believe that thing happened. And I'm always like, because I've been in, you know, I don't know, I've defended like 1,000 cases. I always say like, what thing surprised you? And at the last time I did that, a bunch of people were really surprised because this guy got held. He was like a jeans thief. He stole all like expensive designer jeans and he just kept doing it. He didn't hurt anybody. He just stole a lot of expensive jeans. And the court said, you're held without bail. We're holding you without, he had like 4 open charges and he kept stealing more jeans. But he had never hurt anybody. He had never pushed anybody. He had never even got in an argument with anyone. He'd just go in, shoplift, and then get caught a lot. And the people were saying, I can't believe the court held him. And I was in my, like, having seen this so many times, I was like, well, the way the law is, they must hold him. They actually, the judge really has no choice. Right? Because he was on bail, he got released, he went out and did it again. He did it, probably did it a number of times, then got caught, and then got caught again, and the judge said, I'm not gonna, even though it's a very minor, shoplifting is a minor crime, the judge had no choice. But all of these people were so shocked, and it actually was a moment for me, because I said, oh, right, I should be shocked. I'm just here so often, I'm really jaded to it. And it was a sort of a self-correcting moment, it was a checking moment for me. But I think that's a really great thing. And people can tell those stories. And I'll tell you, you go to Roxbury Court, Dorchester Court, Boston Municipal Court, Somerville, any of these, like, the lower level district courts, and watch a day of arraignments, like people initially, you know, arrested over a weekend and then charged on the Monday. You will be shocked. You'll come out with a million stories and say, this is unbelievable. The process that's happening here, the amount of money, time that is expended trying to put people in jail and prisons. Cause, you know, putting 4 million people under jail, prison, probation, parole, extended supervision, GPS monitoring in the United States, that's a lot. Like, if you had a company that built, you know, 4 million cars, you'd be like, that's a lot of work in a year, right? If you have a company that says, we're going to lock up or put on some form of control 4 million people every year, that's a hell of a lot of work. And in that, right, I don't want to say a lot of mistakes were made, but it's a sausage factory. It's a messy, ugly process. And it's a dehumanizing process. And I think those analogies to Palestine are pretty direct. But the thing I'll say, and I'll just go back to the very beginning, and I brought it with me. I brought a copy of the, I had it somewhere. There it is. Look, I have a copy of the Constitution, cause I carry it around, cause I want to say bad things about it. A lot of times people say to me, they're like, well, it's unconstitutional, right? And people of color will say that to me. And I'm like, but that really wasn't written for us, right? It was explicitly not written for women. It was explicitly not written for black people. It was explicitly not written for native people. And one of the things I say to point to that about the, you know, to point out the, it wasn't broken, it was built like this, is about a tenth of the words of the unamended Constitution are about owning people, are about specifically how black people and native people are not afforded rights, right? That's 10%. That's more than what kind of president we should have. It's more than the separation of powers. It's more than, you know, the construct of Congress or, right? The Constitution doesn't say, it says, well, there should be a Supreme Court, there should be a Congress, and that should have 2 houses, there should be a president, those are the separate branches. It doesn't even spend any words in saying how many people should be on the Supreme Court. Right? It doesn't say, you should have a Supreme Court. We don't want to spend time on how many people should be there. Now we need to spend a lot of time about that, you know, black people should only be represented as proportionally as less human beings, and not even for a number of rights, really for just proportional representation, and native people should count for 0. And they spend quite a bit of time on that, and also quite a bit of time on parts of the Constitution that you could not amend. Parts of the Constitution that you could only amend after a certain set number of years, right? And you think, wow, that must be the really important part. That must be the part like where we can't have a sovereign or we have to have an elected president. No, it was about the part where you can own people and that those laws, states have to respect other states' laws about owning human beings. And I think that what we see today in the United States and what we see in Palestine is just an extension of that structure that was put into the Constitution. I could talk a little bit more about the Declaration of Independence, which is equally racist. But I think it was built in the foundation, so we shouldn't be surprised that we see its extensions today. And we should be mad, but we shouldn't be particularly surprised when we see the United States' extensions into, you know, what is happening, the racial construct of what is happening in to the people in Palestine. Anyway, that's my ramble.
Thank you, Chris. Thank you for all the groups that invited us here to be here. And actually, this is for me. I arrived Friday. We were like touring. We were in a conference in New York. Part of our tour, actually, we do training and workshops for teachers, how to teach Palestine in middle school and high school for teachers. And soon, I hope we will have our website. I have my colleague here, Jody, where she do join me and her. We do this kind of workshop. At the same time, my tour organized by our friend in Vermont, Spark, and my colleague is there. She's the coordinator of our tour. We still have another week. Nicole Awad. In any case, thank you so much to be here. You know, Carl, you are complaining, my friend, a lot, and you have only one government you are dealing with. We, the Palestinian. Okay. How many Palestinian here? Okay. So we deal with two governments, and actually we deal with different kind of laws, because how the system, it's functioning in Palestine. For example, I say Israel, we have is the Israeli law, and because we are living in West Bank, we have the military orders, which is this additional to these laws. At the same time, we have the Palestinian Authority. So, I think Palestinian, they don't need to go to the law school. We are ready to be lawyers soon, because we understand, even when Palestinian prisoners, they go to jail, really they are expertise. They can tell you, your case may be around 2-3 years, your case may be 6 years, because this is generation by generation, and because these military orders now, it's more clear and decree, because the for the Palestinian, they experienced a lot with that. But just to add, I know I'm not a lawyer at all. And before I start, just I want to remind the people. For us, as Palestinian, when we want to use the system or try to defend ourselves, in the Israeli courts, different courts, military courts or the civil, what they call it, civil courts. It's for us, we deal with different kind of laws. In the past, for example, we deal with the Ottoman law, because Palestine under the Ottoman law and for almost 500 years. At the same time, we deal with the British law. And here, when we speak about the prisoners, I want to remind the people, for example, the administrative detention. It is a British law, 1945, where they can keep you in jail for 6 months or 1 year, and they can renew these military order for you whenever they want, without any trial. You don't go to the court. You go to military court, and the lawyer not allowed to see what's in your file. They call it secret file. You can't, the lawyer cannot access that. At the same time, we deal with the Egyptian laws. Because Gaza Strip used to be between 1948 to 67 under the Egyptian rules. And we deal with the Jordanian laws. This is how Israel used the law. And later we deal with the Israeli laws, military orders. All of these laws targeting the Palestinian people. Not, I mean, the Israelis, they pick and they choose what they serve their goal. And by the way, just want to remind you guys, I'm a Palestinian refugee. I want to go back a little bit to the history. This is Serb one goal. People without land for land. Sorry. People without land for land without people. Sorry. It's coming to my mind. Land without people for people without land. All these laws targeting the Palestinian. And here I speak targeting the Palestinian community, all the community, and even targeting our children. This is where later we will explain. But before I start, I'm a Palestinian refugee, and I know maybe some of us here, Palestinian refugees too. And this year, it's the 70th anniversary of the Palestinian Nakba. And sometime I feel this is the right time where we can start. Even if you want to speak about the prison, this is who we are. This is how our story started. I'm not going to 100 years ago. I'm just going back to 1948, and I'll go very quick. I just want to say, can someone turn the lights off here, please? Can you see?
Yes.
This is Palestine, actually, 1878. All what you see here, the Palestinian villages, all the red, I will stand, it's okay? All what you see here, Palestinian villages and towns all over Palestine, all these Palestinian villages. And me, I'm coming from this village here. It's not far from Jerusalem, from Bethlehem. I learned this history actually from my mom. I didn't learn this first in the school or anywhere. I heard this from the stories from my mom. What happened in 1948, part of this actually, what you will see later, some of these footages, I got it from the Israeli archive. The Israelis did the mistake actually in 1998. They opened the archive for a short time. Some of our lawyers, they work on that, they succeed, their friends, they succeed to get some photos about what happened in 1948. I will go faster a little bit. This is my village actually. If you want to see, Carl, where is my village? This is Jerusalem, Bethlehem. We are not that much far. Actually, it's only 25 miles from Jerusalem, and maybe 25 miles the same from Bethlehem. This is our village. I did the research about my village. Remember this photo, actually. This is my village, Zakaria Village. This photo in 1929. My village actually mostly destroyed, except my father's village. This is Zakaria. Mostly destroyed except the mosque, the school, and one of the houses. These are the photos, actually. And here when we speak about what happened in 1948, I will go very fast. Are you familiar, guys, with the ethnic cleansing of Palestine book, Ilan Babe?
Yes.
Do you remember Blan Dalet in Hebrew, they say? In the beginning, how the Zionist group leaders, they sit down together and they plan the ethnic cleansing of Palestine. And plan D actually like this. First, we uproot the people, we throw them out. Second, we destroyed the houses. Third, we plant the trees. And here, some of the photos actually. This is from the Israeli archive. This is a village called Beit Natif, actually. This house still exists until now. Here what you see, these are the Zionist groups in 1948 targeting the Palestinian villages. And here you can see they are sit down, relax, cooking. And when you speak about destroying the houses, you can see this photo. Look to the other one, how they used to explode in the houses and destroy the houses. Other Palestinians, they were arrested. This actually the cover of the ethnic cleansing book for Ilan Babe. But I choose this slide because it reminds me with my mom. My mom, when she left the village, she was without shoes. My mom, she was she had a baby 2 weeks old. My brother, he will be 7 years in October. He was 2 weeks old. My sister, she was 2 years old. And this is remind me with my family. People, they were living near the coast. They used the sea to go to Lebanon and to Syria. Others, they are arrested. They put them in a prison. And later, they deport them. I was in the school, actually, last 2 days. And usually, I show this slide to some classes. And I asked them, because they learn about the Holocaust a lot. And immediately they respond come very quick. All the time they speak about this. This is 1948. And they speak, these are, looks like the Nazi. And even, I told them, look about this, the shorts. And this is the British, actually, the British mandate, the British army in India and Palestine, they used to wear like this in summer shorts. So they are, yani, the Israeli groups, or the Israeli, the Zionist groups, they are taking from both. And this bus actually going to Gaza, the transfer to Gaza. And here just, I remind the people, this is when the victim become a victimizer. When the victim become a victimizer, they know how to hurt. And some victims, they learn how to be in solidarity with other people and become an ally for them. And this is in our case in Palestine. Of course, the Palestinian refugees, the shock, and here where I want to go actually related to my presentation. 750,000 Palestinian refugees in 1948 uprooted from 531 villages, towns, and cities. They went to Lebanon, Syria, Jordan, West Bank, and Gaza. Nadine, you were born in Kuwait, right? And you have relatives, they were in different countries. So we are Palestinian refugees, we are all over, I can say. Especially in the Arab countries. Me too. I have a brother and a sister, I don't know them well. Now I know them a little bit. And recently I use Skype and all this internet stuff to communicate with each other as a family. But still, we Palestinian refugees everywhere. I worked actually with my Masri, a film. I don't know how many of you saw this film, Frontiers. And when I saw in 2000, for the first time, a brother meeting a sister in 50 years. And they were in the fence, one in the Lebanese side and one in the Palestinian side. But this is actually when we speak about Palestinian refugees. The 750,000 in 1948, right now they are close to 8 million Palestinian refugees. I know, it's a huge number, right? We Palestinian refugees, we make children very fast. So the number grow up fast. This is the Esha camp in 1948. You were here in this area, I know. I remember where you were. But these people, they were staying in tents. Later, the United Nations, they built small rooms. Me, personally, I was born in 1964. In a room, by the way, my name is Ziad. Ziad means extra additional. And according to my mom, I came by mistake. This is why they called me extra to the family. I'm the youngest one in the family. Two boys, two girls, and me, so five. And my father and my mom, we were living in one room, 81 square feet, 9 by 9 feet, like these rooms. You can see it more clear here. I was born. Where did you born, Nadav? The same? Oh, almost. Yeah, Nadav from Aida refugee camp, which near our camp. So, and it was 81 square feet, 9 by 9. The problem wasn't that room. The problem, it was the bathroom. Because each 25 rooms has two bathrooms. Each 25 rooms has two bathrooms. One for men, one for women. So as a child, and this is how sometimes what influences you. As a child, you every day you need to wait in lines to use the bathroom. And refugees in general, I can say we are related to the waiting culture. Since you wake up, and when we were children, all the time you need to wait. You go to the bathroom, you need to wait. And you need to wait in lines to receive the food from United Nations. And this kind of, and the food is coming inside us. And until now, Palestine, actually, we are waiting all the time. Not just we are waiting for our right to return back to our villages, but you wait in the checkpoints, you wait in the borders. The moment you show your passport and you are Palestinian, you need to wait somewhere. But I can say, for us, we survived, and we were very lucky to survive And I can say, in our case, we were very lucky to have our moms. Our mothers, they were really fighters. We can see here, this picture actually reminds me with my mom. She used to carry the water on her head. And guys, I moved to the United States 10 years ago. I say this, actually, I access two privileges. I feel I am really very privileged for two reasons. The first one, I can shower every day. I can access the water every day. I know for some of you, it's for granted. You don't think about it. But for us, it's real struggle for us. In the past, we used to shower one time a week. And it depends how our mom, how much she can carry on her head the water, how much she can carry water on her head. And by the way, my mom, for sure, she passed away. If you see her shoulders, if she participated in the international championship for bodybuilding, maybe she will win. And most of her generation like this. And most of women, if we look in Africa or Latin America or India, just look to the shoulders of these women carrying, especially the marginalized communities, where they carry this water for long and walking miles to get there. And this is how, for us as children, this is the way how we grew up. Watching this. I got my education, this United Nations school, and I got my education, actually, I remember, I learned that Columbus discovered America in our curriculum. When I went to prison the first time, I was very young, I find out Columbus did not discover America. The right education, we got it there, actually. So this is the school. But this is where you used to go to school, but sometime during the night, this is the school we, as young people, and sometime our families, and our teachers, where you used to be tortured. And sometimes we are tortured in the classroom. Late 70s, early 80s, they used to call the, of course, they used to impose curfew and call the loudspeakers. Every male from 14 to 60, they need to go to the playground to the school. And sometimes you spend hours and hours in winters. And they do interrogation. They use the classroom where you go to learn to interrogate. I watched when I was young, actually, one of the teachers, he was actually physically attacked by the soldiers. And it wasn't like one time or two times. For a long, long time, they used to do that. Now, in our walls, if you go to the Hesha concentration camp, I don't know if you saw that before. Our youth, actually, they did that. They want to remind the Israeli army that don't forget the concentration camp. Here we were behind the fence. I know now we have the wall in Palestine, and you guys will hear a lot about the walls. You have Baja California, and still there is a big discussion in D.C. about the wall. It's now the fashion walls. But we experienced this in our refugee camp. Our refugee camp, by the way, it's less than square a mile. We had the fence isolate the camp, 8 meters high, and we had one gate for the people to leave or to enter the camp between 1985 until December 21st, 1995. So this is my refugee camp right now. A lot of changes happened, but this is part of the daily life. And of course, we grew up in this reality, and it reminds me when we were children, because I am the youngest, and my mom, she did her best to keep me out of politics. She thought she can take care of me so I can finish my education, not like my brothers and sisters. But my mom failed. She couldn't do that. Because in our case, actually, for our children and for us, we didn't choose to be political people. In our case, politics chose us. And the conditions which people they live under, actually, influence their perspectives, decisions, and actions. And this is natural result for someone living in the refugee camp. I went to jail the first time because I was throwing stones. And it was normal react. And I can do another presentation, actually another presentation about how you feel about this. When you throw the stone, which kind of feeling you have inside yourself. And how much your shoulders come up. You feel proud of yourself because you are struggling. And you keep your struggle. And this is normal in different ways. This is one of the photos actually in front of our refugee camp. But this is one of the famous photos. You can see this child in front of the big tanks. The same other pictures from our refugee camp, which you can see how the people, they are arrested. And here we are coming to the issue. When we speak about prisoners in Palestine, especially like how the Israelis, they have a strategy since 1948, how to target, how to attack and destroy the Palestinian spirit. Part of the ethnic cleansing policy to make it difficult for the people to live, to survive, and to resist. And part of this plan actually targeted our children. I know you see Ahed Tamimi, right? Most of you know this picture. Do you know about Nariman, guys? Her mom. Ahed sentenced for 8 months and 5,000 shekel, like $1,500. Fine. Her mom sentenced 8 months, the same like her, 6,000. It's like $1,700. But I know Ahed Tamimi now is like become all over the world and represent our youth, Palestinian youth struggle. But there are actually right now in Israeli jails, I checked the statistics this morning, which this statistics can change every day. Because every night, anyone wake up that morning, check the Palestinian local news, you will find how many people they are arrested. And this number actually growing up all the time. So, right now we have 34 women inside Israeli jail. Among them, 8 women, 8 girls below 18 years old. One of them, Ahed. The same for the boys, you can see. Below 18 years. 34 women, among them, 8 girls below 18 years old. Here we can see these kind of footages for Palestinian children. And part of the work we do, actually, I'm working in Berkeley in Mecca Middle East Children's Alliance. And we support a project in Silwan neighborhood. I don't know, have you been Silwan near Jerusalem? Anyone know Silwan neighborhood? There is an organization called MADA. And recently, how they target Jerusalem, actually, where Silwan, it's part of this goal for the Israeli administration. And if you go to Silwan, it's a Palestinian neighborhood, but inside Silwan you will find, I think, over 12 buildings inside Silwan for settlers. They are living inside the neighborhood. They confiscated these houses, and they have two kinds of security. First, they have the private company to protect the settlers, and you have the Israeli army to protect the private company and to protect the settlers. And of course, this is part of the daily life in this neighborhood and around Jerusalem. So, for the children, when they go to school, all the time they are stopped, searched. And many times they arrest the children. And in Silwan, they put many children under home arrest. And think about this. These are the laws. Sometimes they use it. They don't want to keep a big number of Palestinian children inside Israeli jails. Sometimes they impose on the family your child under home arrest. And the duty of the parents to keep this child in the house. Because if the child will leave the house, the parents, they need to pay a fine, minimum $1,000. So in this case, they transferred, or the parents became a jailers.
Yeah.
To keep the children. And children, actually, when they are inside the house, they are children. They want to go out. And even because this kind of the relationship between the father and the mom and the dad, actually, they don't want the child to go out. They don't have money to pay a fine. And the relationship here, it is broken. So we have a project actually there where we support psychologists, social workers, and sometimes teachers where they can continue these children at home to keep them connected to the school and support them. Here other like statistics. I know there are maybe in some other countries there are children, they go to the court, but no country in the world. They have between 500 to 700 children each year go to the military court. Do you have military court here?
Oh, we have military court. Yes.
So do you have children that go to the military court? So we are lucky. We are like... So 500 to 700, they go to the military court. And this is, if we think about this, the ethnic cleansing actually, generation by generation. And me, I'm right now 53 years old, but I still remember when I was a child. I will never forget that. This is actually, I think today, in Palestinian time.
In Hebron,
of course.
At this point, Ziad showed a news clip from that very day showing a 3-year-old child being detained by the Israeli military. The child was screaming and crying, and his parents were not allowed access to him. Finally, one of his brothers, about 10 years old, bravely walks to the child and leads him away, and the Israeli military astonishingly just lets him do so. Quite a scene. Following the showing of this news clip, Ziad picks up and offers some commentary.
A lot of these kind of footages, we see it in Hebron. And for me, not just because the child is 3 years old. We have this kind of footages coming from Hebron, especially from Hebron and from different parts of Palestine. And if you follow Ahed Tamimi since she was a child, how she grew up. And the story of Ahed Tamimi, actually, there is no need to go. Just go to the internet and find. And there is a new film coming about her and her cousin, etc. But these children, you see them, the way how they grew up. And what I like in this video, his brother, a child, came and they released the brother. And this is sometimes it's okay. Our children, they are victims, but the victims, they fight and they resist. And you see the brother, how he came inside and he grabbed the father or I don't know, the adult to try to argue with the soldier. Hey, let him lead the child, etc. But the child, and this is with the new generation. This new generation, like even they are stronger than our generation. And this is generation by generation, how it moves, and they learn. I want to say just more statistics here very quick. 6,000 Palestinian political prisoners right now in Israeli jails. Among them, I said 34 women, 8 girls, but right now, all girls and boys, 356 children today in Israeli jails. Right now, they are below 18 years old. And actually, I met with Nidal a little bit, and we were speaking about the prison, that the Israelis, they have special prisons for children, military prisons. And by the way, one of the famous jail actually, called Al-Fara'a jail. Now it's not exist. But Al-Fara'a, it's like you are going for camping. Some people, they used to go every 3-4 months, they arrest them. And it's only to torture the children. I went there a few times when I was young, and this is to kill and destroy your spirit, to break down your spirit. And they use different kind, actually, of torture. And sometimes they target the people, target the children, and they shoot the children, they kill children. Yeah, there is a lot of information online in U.S. campaign. And this is something I really ask the people to be involved and to do something around it here in the United States. The other thing I will say, you know, of course, about the American support to Israel, the $4 billion every year and all this kind of stuff. So I'm not going to ask the American government to support the Palestinian. If they want to support the Palestinians, please stop your support to Israel. We will be okay. And if they take this $4 billion instead to go to Israel, and they will use it here to develop schools. I know in Oakland, where we are right now, they are closing schools. In Chicago, they are closing schools. And to keep the school open, they use the $4 billion here. Be sure. I think this is the connection sometime where we find ourselves. That the American people and the American children, they deserve this $4 billion more better than send it to build walls and support apartheid regime inside in Israel. The other thing, it's prison is a prison. And I was telling the story before, I will go very quick. When I was a child, I went to Ramallah. They took me to Ramallah jail and they put me in the prison. I was very naive or stupid, I don't know. But I was in this section and the name of the section, not the Israelis, they do that, the prisoners, Angela Davis, they put the name. And for me, because I'm naive, I thought, Angela Davis, she's a Palestinian Christian, maybe from Bethlehem, Mejala. And later on, I learned about Angela Davis, and this is like we were children. Of course, they were other section called Bobby Sands.
All right.
The North Irish, you know, the Irish fighter. And sometimes the real solidarity and real, I call it the joint struggles among prisoners more than out the prison, because this is what we call it, the connection between the suffering language or the resistant language or feelings or motivation among the prisoners. I will stop here, guys, and I will leave it for you.
And that is where we have to leave it. Our time is up. But you have heard the major presentations of Carl Williams and Ziad Samrouche in their coffeehouse presentations in Harvard Yard, sponsored by the Cambridge Bethlehem People to People Project and several Harvard student organizations. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You will find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. To access our permanent archive to hear any of our past broadcasts, go to truthandjusticeradio.org, all one word, truthandjusticeradio.org, and click on This Week in Palestine Archive. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday. And this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.